Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And our studio guest on today's show is Beth Lynch, here to talk about her memoir, Where the Hornbeam Grows, A Journey in Search of a Garden. We also hear from Anne Levin on her memoir, Incandescent. We need to talk about light, about her own relationship with artificial lighting. And Melissa Fu chats to us about her poetry collection, Falling Outside Eden. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Beth, but welcome to Bookmark. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Lee. Thank you.
Now, we've got a poet and a memoirist on today's show, as well as yourself, which is appropriate for me because your memoir is very poetic. Have you written before? This is your first book?
It's my first non-academic book. I had a previous life as an academic, so I've published in different capacities, but this might be my first sort of mass market book. Yes, it was a whole new experience for me.
Was it?
Yes, absolutely. I had no idea what I was getting into, and I took the plunge, and it happened. Really,
did it come easy to you? It reads very easily. It's very beautiful, as I say, very poetic.
In a way, it did actually, surprisingly so. I think I had no expectations, and I found myself in a situation where I wanted to write because I had an opportunity in my life. I was between careers when I was living in Switzerland. I'd always wanted to write. And I had some idea that I would write a book about enclosed gardens and a much more sort of technical, historical book. And I realised that I wasn't connecting with it. And then gradually my own story began to filter into it, and I just went with it, really. Yes.
And landscape writing, it always seems to me, is very challenging because how do you describe a sunset, a flower, a tree without being repetitive?
I didn't really think about it in those terms. I guess I just wrote, and I write very slowly. So there was a lot. It took me a long time to put chapters together in a way, but it was quite a progressive thing. And all the while that I was living in Switzerland, which of course is where most of the book is set, and hiking and then working in this extraordinarily beautiful little garden that we found out in the mountains where we lived for a while, I noted things down a bit, but I just wrote things down as they were, really. Obviously, I shaped it in when I was writing the book a little bit, but it was a surprisingly happy, sort of easy experience writing, which is completely unlike my experience of academic writing, actually. And that was quite a process of discovery for me, yes.
Well, we'll talk very much about your book over the course of the show, but we'll listen now to your first choice of music, which is the first movement by Max Bruch, Concerto for Violin and Orchestra in G minor. Why this one?
I chose this piece because I think it's pretty much hardwired into me. I grew up in a house without a television. My parents listened to a lot of music, and my bed was above the sitting room, and I must have heard this piece countless times when I was asleep or going to sleep or lying in bed thinking. And so that would have been a recording by Yehudi Menuhin, but many years later I heard an Austrian violinist called Benjamin Schmid playing this at the Cambridge Corn Exchange, and that opened up new perspectives on the piece, the physicality and the precision and the nuance. So this is Benjamin Schmid.
And that's the first movement by Max Bruch, Concerto for Violin and Orchestra in G minor. The first choice of music today from our studio guest on Bookmark, Beth Lynch. Beth read English at Cambridge and completed a doctorate in 17th century literature. She then worked as a lecturer, creating gardens in her spare time before training as a garden designer. Where the Hornbeam Grows was published last year. It's a memoir about overcoming loss, connecting with the past and finding a place in the world by establishing a garden and working with the land, literally putting down roots. Olivia Lang, a previous guest on this show, called it a tender, wise meditation on grief, home and the restorative magic of making a garden. The Daily Mail described it as lyrical and fiercely funny. And the great Robert McFarlane, current king of landscape writing, called it subtle and moving. I agree with all of those, Beth. It's a beautiful read. And of course, we'll talk about the book in detail. Let's backpedal for a moment a little bit, although you do cover this in the book as well. The beginning of your love for landscape and nature. It began very early on, didn't it? It came from your parents.
Yes, it did. Yes, in rural East Sussex, in a garden which I will carry around with me in my heart forever. It made me a gardener, and my parents came from very humble backgrounds. They had very little money, and they grafted and bought a small plot of land in a part of a field on a hill in Sussex that they loved very much, and created a garden and built a house, and that's where it all started.
And you say you carry it around in your heart forever, that garden. It is very present.
Absolutely,
in the book. What was it about that garden? What was in that garden? It's how long have we got?
Yes, it is. I was going to say it's a difficult question, but it's not difficult. It's a complicated one. It's where I first it is bound up with home and childhood, but it's also where it made me a gardener, it's where I learned. I spent so much time just pottering around. My parents were always gardening, and actively tried to involve me in gardening, but it was just something that they did, and I was always fiddling around and digging up germinated acorns from the lawn and doing things at the edges and the margins and had little experiments going on, sewing, I remember sewing a clementine pip. I talk about that in the book, and one thing and another, and what we did, really, in a way, and it was never really discussed. It was just part of the way of things, the garden was bounded by a fairly ancient piece of woodland, and I spent a lot of time. I had an incredibly free range childhood, so I was always roaming around in the woods and fiddling around in the hedgerows, and I realised with hindsight that this affinity just grew really with me. It's part of who I am, and it was never forced or in any kind of way. It was just what.
Now that comes through
what
in the
I
book.
Did. Yes,
it's in you, and
yes.
It's almost beyond words.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think I've given a fairly vague answer to your question, but yeah, it is. It's just something that's kind of innate, really. And it's something for which I'm profoundly grateful. It sustains me. It's sustained me in many ways over the years, and it does still. And it's something that I can just take with me, and I can I can rediscover in new places, which is tremendously important if you move around as much as I have done in my life. So I mean, that the subtitle of the book is A Journey in Search of a Garden, and of course the on one level that garden is the garden that I found and created in Switzerland, but the garden is also this metaphorical emotional garden that started in Sussex in my parents' garden and is with me, yes.
And it's where you first encountered the hornbeam.
Absolutely.
Which is a motif in the book, in the title. For those of us, I know a little bit more about them, quite a lot more now about the hornbeam than I did at the beginning of your book. For those people who don't, if you could describe it and say just what it is that captivates you.
A lot of people would regard it as a very bog standard shrub, though I don't think no shrub is bog standard, but it's a very common native British tree, which is often or shrub, which is often found in hedgerows, is indigenous to the south of England, The wood that bounded our garden is full of hornbeam, and our garden had a hornbeam hedge, and it's just the most beautiful plant. It grows into a big tree, or you can keep it contained as a hedge, and it has the most beautiful sort of sinuous flowing trunks and branches that when the leaves are all shed in winter, it looks almost animate in a way, and the foliage is just lovely, soft, serrated, beautiful bright green foliage, and it's just something that I love, it's very special. It's so common, but it's so special.
And you talked about establishing your garden in Switzerland.
Yes.
And it was kind of establishing the hornbeam there was one there, establishing the garden was about more than that, wasn't it? It was about finding a sense of connection there.
Yes, it was,
because
yes.
Because you'd previously lived in the city without one. Did you realise before you felt... I mean, there were quite sad and difficult times there,
yes,
before you moved,
yes,
out to the garden in the country. Did you realise before then how much having a garden would meant to you and how not having a garden would affect you?
I don't think I realised it before we moved to Switzerland. I always had a garden in the UK before we left, and that was tremendously important to me. And I mean, in fact, as you mentioned, I trained as a garden designer, and then we moved to Switzerland, and we were living in a third floor flat in central Zurich, and I was I was pining for a garden. I was pining for soil and things, but I think that was, it's difficult to disentangle that from all the other bewildering and difficult things that I was experiencing, having moved abroad and finding myself, yes, at sea. And and then when we decided to look for a garden, find me a garden, and we bought this little cottage out in the Jura Mountains, and this extraordinary wild edged place, and it was beyond anything I could ever have dreamed of. Actually, it was because it was so wild, and it was just phenomenal. Yes, and it's difficult. I couldn't say whether that extraordinariness was a function of not having had a garden, or having been without a garden for a while, or because it was so special. Because by any standards, it was just a truly
unique
place.
Well, there are gardens,
yes,
and gardens,
yes,
aren't there?
Yes,
and
there are, yes.
You describe your kind of garden. It's,
yes,
not an ornamental garden at all.
No. It's very, very wild, well, I was going to say wild around the edges, but it's actually innately wild, and then it has spaces where you kind of shape and coax and obviously you're always imposing yourself on a garden when you're gardening and you're creating a garden, but I like to try and, you know, keep myself in check a little bit, and it's about working with nature. And of course, you're shaping. It's a paradox, but you're shaping and planning a little bit. But in this garden, which was right in the middle of the countryside, and we had a little patch of wild meadow and woodland and there was, you know, there were things that people dismiss as weeds, terrible things like ground elder and bindweed coming in through the edges, but that was fine. It's just about some shaping and negotiating that space.
It sounds beautiful. And we're just about to hear from Anna Levin about light, about artificial lighting, but natural light, such an important part of a garden. I mean, you were
absolutely
in Zurich before, this grey, very hostile city actually to you, and then you moved out to the mountains. The difference must have been phenomenal.
It was. It was extraordinary. Yes. We did a little bit of work on the house when we moved in. It was a tiny little cottage, and it had this this steep sloping roof, which blocked the access from the living room to the garden, and we literally raised the roof, and had a huge window put in, and that light, got the light into the house, and we turned it into a place in which you're almost literally sort of living, you know, in the garden, and it was very, very beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you, Beth. It is very vivid in the book. Let's hear from Anna now. Anna Levin was formerly a section editor at BBC Wildlife magazine and a contributing editor with the magazine at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh. She collaborated with photographer Laurie Campbell for her first book, Otter's Return to the River, published in 2014. And she was editor of the Wildlife Photographer of the Year, portfolios 11 and 13. Last year saw the publication of a memoir, Incandescent, We Need to Talk About Light, which detailed her own fraught relationship with artificial lighting and its impact on the environment. I asked Anna, when did she first realise she had a problem with artificial light?
It came on quite suddenly. It was back in 2013. I was on a training course in Birmingham, and it was that really dark spring where it felt like winter had the year in its teeth and it wasn't letting go. And they put the lights on in the afternoon in the conference centre, and pretty much as soon as they put the lights on, I started feeling just weird, for want of a better word. Very strange, dizzy, sick and disorientated. Couldn't get my words out properly and feeling like my head was sort of swelling, floating above me in a weird way.
Why then? Because presumably you'd experienced that kind of lighting before.
I don't have an explanation for it, and nor did the GP, but when I went to the doctor after, she said if she had a penny for every time somebody said to her, well, I've eaten bread all my life, how can I suddenly not tolerate it now? Or I'm a gardener and I've worked with plants all my life, but suddenly I'm getting a rash from this one. And maybe there's a tipping point or the body blows a fuse.
And what kind of lighting is it in particular that you have a problem with?
The lighting that I have the most problem with is what was called the low-energy lighting, compact fluorescent lights, which is CFLs. They're the curly ones that look a bit space-age. And when incandescent lighting was first banned, they were the lights that were the default lighting, really, for domestic use.
So these are the low-energy light bulbs that we're all encouraged to use to save the planet?
Absolutely, and were very much promoted by the green movement, by everybody that was concerned about climate change.
And what is the problem? What do they do to you and how?
What they do to me is still a mystery. But in trying to find out what they do to me, what I discovered was that people all over the world were having problem with them, that it wasn't just me, because I went to my GP and she was very sympathetic but said the technology is so new that the medicine hasn't necessarily caught up yet. So she sent me to a dermatologist and a psychologist and a neurologist and every ologist she could think of. And they all said, we don't know. The research hasn't been done. And I started thinking, is this not a bit upside down? Surely you would do the research first to check that a product was safe before putting it on the market, let alone banning the alternative. So I started to blog about it just to try and make sense of it. And people all over the world started writing to me and telling me their stories. And it wasn't just anecdotal evidence from people, but some of the medics I was sent to, you know, they were publishing papers saying that these lights can damage the skin of healthy individuals, as well as cause a lot of problems for people with skin conditions. And that's, you know, in the published research. And the government advice actually at the time was that you shouldn't be closer than half a metre to them for more than an hour a day. Yet they were sold as craft lamps, they're in hospital beds, reading lamps. So there's a disjunct really between what's being found out about them and how they're actually used.
And why are they having this effect? What is it about them that's doing this to you?
We don't know. And that's,
you don't know that?
No, we don't know that. And I mean, this is 5 years of research and seeing all sorts of different specialists. And what I discovered when I started writing the book was just how little is known about light. We take light for granted because it seems so every day, and you get a light bulb, you get a different shaped light bulb. Surely that's the same thing. But the stuff that comes out of a CFL is actually different phenomena of physics than the stuff that comes out of an incandescent light bulb that we grew up with, or, you know, firelight that we evolved with. And there's a number of issues that could be causing problems with people from CFLs. They flicker a lot, and it's been shown that we all have very different flicker thresholds. So somebody might be really disturbed by flicker and somebody else not notice it. And sometimes you can't see it flickering, but your brain can still perceive it, and that's been scientifically proven. They've also got a very irregular spectrum. So they've got a lot of blue light, but the shape of the light frequency is very spiky with gaps in it. And they think both the spikes and the gaps might be a problem. It's all quite complex physics, but in part of researching the book, I talked to leading physicists, and what they told me was a complete surprise, which was that they don't understand light either, that actually nobody really knows what it is. Einstein said that people who said they understand light were kidding themselves. It's a complex, multifaceted thing. So whatever we measure, we're not measuring something else, because there's a lot of different aspects to light.
And you mentioned how it made you feel unwell, and it affects your skin as well?
It doesn't affect my skin. Actually, the dermatology department was one of the first to publish about it, because I think the effect of light on skin was the most noticeable. And other people were getting rashes and bleeding and weeping and all sorts of problems. And some people with existing skin problems and lupus, which is a condition that can affect your skin, were having huge problems with these lights. I tested completely clear for that. So they haven't actually found out what aspect of the lights was a problem for me. But that really fascinated me. I think that's what drove me on to write the book and explore it deeper, because people that were getting in touch with me were having such diverse symptoms. Some of it was dermatological with skin problems. A lot of people were having headaches and eye pain and brain fog. And some people were losing coordination, fainting, nausea. There was one man who walked into a room with CFLs and he would literally collapse. So something was interrupting the signals from his brain to his limbs. It would be simple if everyone that had a problem with this form of lighting had the same symptoms. But the fact that it affects so many things just made me realise how powerful light is and how little we understand about it.
And how does it affect you on a day-to-day level? I mean, before you did this interview here, for example, you came and looked at the lighting here at Cambridge 105. How else does it affect you?
It affects all sorts of things, because lighting is everywhere in the built environment. So things like going into the children's school, both my children's schools in Cambridge have CFL lighting. The doctor's doesn't here, but it did where I lived before. So you really have to avoid this type of lighting, and that's really the only way. I have no other health problems, so I can be perfectly healthy if I stay away from these lights. You have to recce before you do anything. It's really checking the changing room in swimming pools, checking pubs, toilets everywhere. But my life personally is getting easier, because CFLs are now seeding to the new type of lighting, which is LED. And people say to me, it's all going to be okay now because CFLs are going, and they're actually going to be banned in the next round of legislation, which brings my story full circle to some extent, because this all began because incandescent lighting was banned. Now CFLs are going to be banned, mainly because of their mercury content. People decided it wasn't a great idea to have mercury in every house. And LEDs is the new type of lighting, some of which I'm okay with, but LED lighting is also causing enormous health problems for a lot of people. So it really isn't as simple as, oh, we'll get this new light and we'll get this new light. This has to be researched first, and we really have to find out what's going on and understand a lot more about light and life and how it interacts.
And you detail in the book the effects this lighting has on the environment and wildlife.
I was quite slow to realise how much this was an environmental story and how much this was a wildlife story, which is a bit ironic, as in my day job I actually work in wildlife journalism, but I was so caught up in the health and the social justice side of it, really, because it's created a form of social exclusion, because people can't go out and work and function normally. They have problems with this lighting. But it was only when I was quite deep into it that I started learning about the effect on the natural world, which is very much affected by artificial light in two ways. One is the increase in quantity, because there's way more artificial light at night than there has ever been, and that's still growing more and more. And the other is the change in quality, that the new type of lighting uses a bluer end of the light spectrum, and that's been shown to have quite fundamental effects on the natural world within individual species, whether it's a tree or a bird or a dog whelk on the seashore. Light is time in the natural world and the cues for nearly every physiological process in us and in animals and plants. The circadian rhythm, which we're hearing a lot about, isn't just about waking and sleeping, but it's about everything that goes on in our bodies, from our blood sugar to our cell renewal to our hormones and endocrines. Every system is cued by that body clock, which is cued by light. And if you start changing light, you start messing with that.
What was the most surprising thing that you found during the research for the book?
I was at a dark skies conference to learn more about light and life, and I found myself at breakfast sitting by a marine biologist. And I asked him to pass the marmalade and sort of said, what's a marine biologist doing here? I didn't think that the dark skies issue and the light pollution issue would affect the ocean. But he said that it's actually as significant as climate change for the disruption of the natural world. You've got the problems with the lights along the coast, you've got the problems of the ships, but you've also got things like squid fishing, which are deep sea fishing using light. So they're projecting incredibly bright light into the ocean to attract certain things. But we know what that attracts, but we don't necessarily know what it repels. And ecologists talk of the cascading effect, where you affect one species and then you don't know what implications that has, on and on and on. That was a shock to me.
And as well as doing all this research, you were sharing your own experiences in the book. How did that feel? How did you decide how much to share?
I guess that was the only way I could write it, really, because I'm not a scientist, I'm not an expert, I'm very new to the subject, and the only way I could write a book about it was to bring the reader along with me as I went out exploring, really, as a journalist and asking questions. So the only story I could tell was my own, and I hope that that resonates with people.
And what's your takeaway message for the book? If when people put the book down, you want them to do one thing or remember one thing, what would it be?
That we need to talk about light. I think we grossly underestimate the power and the effect of light on our lives and on everything else. And that's including daylight and the amount of it and the type of light and how much we're on screens. And I think when we're thinking about health, we tend to think about maybe fitness or stress, or we talk about diet relentlessly. But to think about light as a nutrient that you're taking in, and that the quality of the light affects the quality of your life.
And Incandescent, We Need to Talk About Light by Anna Levin is published by Saraband. Listening to that with me today, our studio guest on Bookmark, Beth Lynch, here to talk about her memoir, Where the Hornbeam Grows. I mean, certainly we're talking about lighting, certainly yes. Where you were in Switzerland in your garden, very yes. different from where you were before in a
yes.
town.
Absolutely.
You must have different world altogether, things that come
completely.
Out
yes.
without artificial lighting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's the... the most extraordinary story that I've just heard from Anna, and I completely relate to a lot of what she says. Actually, obviously, I've never suffered in the way that she has done, but that sense that light is a nutrient, and it's something that just affects everything, whether you're aware of it or not, and that's something that I. That with hindsight was a huge change to me moving out to the Jura. We were right in the middle of the countryside, and the sky was completely dark at night. You could see stars and stars beyond stars, and it was extraordinary. And then being in touch with the rhythms and the cycles of the days and the seasons. And it's a simple thing, and it's a huge thing. And I realise now what a privilege it is to be able to experience that, for that to be part of your life on a daily basis, as it was for me for a while. And yes, really, really, very, you know, it's a hugely important issue.
Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Anthem by Leonard Cohen. Why this one?
I could have chosen pretty much any song by Leonard Cohen from my very extensive collection. but I chose Anthem because I think this is such a song for our times, at least as much as it was for the early 90s when Cohen first wrote it, when he wrote it. And the version that we're going to hear was recorded live at a concert that I was very privileged to attend at the O2 in 2008. And Cohen was well into his 70s. And it was just a very special experience. The atmosphere was, and the chemistry were extraordinary, and it was a moment in time, but the song speaks for itself.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our studio guest on Bookmark today is Beth Lynch, here to talk about her memoir, Where the Hornbeam Grows. Beth, we've talked about gardens a lot, establishing a garden. Obviously, that's one of the themes of your memoir. The other theme is loss,
yes,
really, because it was the loss of your parents that runs also through the book, and the connection, yes, with your own grief that you helped finding a garden helped.
Absolutely.
And
yes.
I can see on your, yes, face now that it's still very, very strong for you and very raw.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, it is. I suppose the garden, the loss of my parents' garden,
take a moment. Are you okay to talk about
Yes,
this?
I am. Sorry.
I brought you something because it's in the book, but I don't want to upset you. But if you're
thinking about your question, really. Because when my mother died, and my mother was obviously she was the plants woman of the marriage and of the garden. My father did more of the structural stuff and maintenance. And when my mother died, my father threw himself into learning about plants and gardening, and I was just I around that time I'd actually got a garden of my own, my first garden, and I while gardening was in my blood, as it were, I didn't know much about gardening, about shrubs and perennials. I knew about little sort of childhood experiments, but I didn't know anything about gardening. So my father and I really sort of learnt together, and my father, as my father was developing and looking after my mother's garden, their garden, sort of for my mother, for himself, for my mother's memory, as it were, I was learning more about gardening. So we did a lot together, and we learnt together, and we went to nurseries together, about a year or so after my mother's death, my father found an old shopping list, a number of plants that my mother had wanted to buy, and she never had a chance to, because she died very suddenly. And so we embarked on this mission to source all of these plants. It was a number of hardy geraniums, and that was a tremendous project. It was just a wonderful thing that we did, and it was sad, but it was a lovely thing, and that really characterizes a lot of the my subsequent relationship with my father. Actually, I mean, we talked every day on the phone, and at 6 o'clock, give or take, and we were always talking about our gardens. And then when my father died, obviously we had to sell the family home. My siblings and I had moved away, and that was a very strange, quite a special time for me in a way. It was desperately, I mean, to say it was sad is an understatement, but I found myself reconnecting with the garden in new ways as I was saying goodbye to it. And I was going back, I was helping my brother get the house ready for sale, but we were still looking after the garden, and I found myself digging up bits of plants and taking cuttings, a lot which are the vegetal origins of plants I have today in my garden in Cambridge, and they've moved around with me, and I've given bits to friends, and on that level, but also in a much bigger kind of emotional way, I suppose, the garden again has become it's almost kind of afterlife, I suppose. And it's actually literally an afterlife. These living green things that are still growing, and so yes, it's I, I've I realise how much of my relationship with my parents has been sort of played out, sort of in sort of manifested in sort of, you know, in gardens and gardening and the connections with plants, and that's something that never fails, never ceases to fill me with wonder, is the extent to which plants and gardens actually connect you with people.
It did feel that way. The longer, the more connected you felt to the garden, to the soil, almost.
Yes,
the more
absolutely.
You had your fingers in the earth, the more you were connected to them and to your own grief.
Absolutely. But it's also about growth and new connections and taking things forward. And I'm always pressing bits of plants on, particularly plants that originated in my parents' garden. I'm pressing them onto friends, and they're finding their way much further out into the world now. And that gives me great joy to think about that, actually. Yes.
Thank you, Beth. So, thank you. We'll take a breather. Take a break. We'll hear from Melissa Funa. Melissa was the regional winner of the Words and Women 2016 prose competition and was a 2017 apprentice with Word Factory. Her writing has appeared in publications including International Literature Showcase, Envoy and Bear Fiction. From 2018 to 2019, she was the David T.K. Wong Fellow at the University of East Anglia. Falling Outside Eden is her first poetry collection, and I asked her why, first of all, why that title?
The title comes from the sections of the collection itself. So when I was putting the poems together, I was working with a friend and we were sorting them into possible ideas or themes, and then it emerged that one was about the beginning of a romance, which is Eden, or a relationship of some kind, and then falling is the fall, going out, all the things that might go wrong, and then outside is the end and what is found after you leave a place that you thought was so Edenic.
Were they written towards being a collection, or did you just find that actually they had this theme without you realizing?
Most of them were not written towards a collection. I think the oldest one is, I'll show my age here, it's probably close to 20 years old. I just wrote it as an exercise in what was my first poetry class. And then the most recent ones were maybe just a few months old when I submitted the collection for publication. But somewhere in between, I had sat down with a friend, and it again came out of this process of finding the themes. And I had many, many poems. I think I printed out maybe 40, close to 50. And we just whittled away the ones that seemed to suggest these ideas.
So looking back on the poetry that you wrote up to 20 years ago, did you see a change?
I think so. Well, those older ones I would revise and revise, so they've been brought up to date over the years. I actually haven't written much poetry since this I sent out just over a year ago, and I really haven't written much poetry then, so I think if I wrote poetry now, it probably would feel different. I'd notice a change.
And there are lots of different forms in this book.
Yeah.
You're playing with that idea of form.
I often will start with an idea of a form, maybe not a formal form like Sestina or haiku or ghazal, but I'll look for some kind of break that makes sense in the lines or some kind of shape on the page. And then at some point in the poem, I always try to break that form.
You're from New Mexico. How much does that influence your writing?
Strangely, not so much in this collection. When I first started writing, everything that I wrote about was about New Mexico. And that was the main driving force for why I wanted to write and what I wanted to say. Living so far away from New Mexico, first in different places in the States, and then for the past several years here in England, in Cambridge, I felt so homesick for New Mexico. But I think I've written my way out of that for the moment. So I'm not sure if any of these poems in particular have much to do with New Mexico, which is a little bit of a surprise to me.
It's published by the Hedgehog Poetry Press, a small press. How have you found working with them?
Oh, Hedgehog is fantastic. I've really, really enjoyed it. It's a tiny press. It's one person, a guy called Mark Davidson. He's really imaginative in how he goes about looking for poets and writers and publishing them. He kind of throws his net really wide. and introduced me to a lot of exciting voices. I loved working with him as an editor. He had quite a light touch with me.
Given that this is about the progress of a relationship, how personal are these poems to you?
It's a funny question. In some ways, they are very personal in that each individual poem I could probably track back to an individual person or event that I have in mind. But the overall relationship that it imagines or the arc that it imagines isn't anyone that actually existed, because I've drawn on so many different details of different moments.
I've spoken with poets about this before, that we assume more than we do in novels that the I in poetry, the first person, refers to the poet in a way that we wouldn't assume that in prose.
I think it's a version of me, but in the end I would say now that they're written and now that they I'm not playing with them anymore or editing, it's no longer me, it's somebody else. Maybe in the writing of it, in poetry, the I starts with me and my own experiences and thoughts but I think as it moves into being a poem and maybe gets a little bit better through the versions, I think it moves farther away from me, Melissa, and just becomes the floating I of poetry.
And I love the photograph on the front. That's quite personal to you, isn't it?
Oh, yes, the photo. My son took the photo.
It's beautiful. And you made the connection between the photograph and having it as the front cover.
He loves photography. And so I just went around the house and picked up a few things that I thought had some resonance with some of the poems and then put him in charge. And I'm glad I put him in charge.
Yeah, it looks great. And you're going to read some poetry for us now.
I'm going to read two poems from two different sections. The first poem is from Eden, and those have a little bit of a more anticipatory or hopeful tone. So this poem is called We Were Dreaming of Watermelon. We were dreaming of watermelon, of the thump of ripeness, the cracking of green mottled skin revealing a flush of pink flesh, of drip and slurp and crunch, of hard black-brown seeds spit far, 10 feet, 12 feet, scattered and dusty, of drip and slurp and crunch, of tiny white seeds still nestled in the fruit, swallowed whole in greedy mouthfuls, of drip and slurp and crunch, of juice running down cheeks and elbows, leaving sticky trails of drip and slurp and crunch, of ants like vultures itching to climb carcasses of pale rinds, waiting to devour any spots of sweetness left behind. And then the second poem I'm going to read is from the section called Falling. That's, well, when things are starting to maybe fall apart a little bit. It's called Still Life. Outside, it is snowing, and that is where I want to be. I want to be there while tree boughs, freed of leaves, hold first their own shapes and then the snow. Then the snow, armful by armful, gathers up and reaches back towards the clouds it came from. You are sleeping. Under thick blankets and dreams, you drift away from a life we once shared. In the night, a stranger is wearing the scarf I lost. The scarf I lost was whipped away by the winds. No, it fell because I was following you and I forgot. And I forgot to notice because the night was mild and the light was long and you were city blocks away. On the table, a glass of water evaporates, drop by drop, becomes air again, makes the room heavy with moisture. There is a playground. There is too much moon. I can't say if the air is laced with frost. I can't say your name. Your name, creaky swings, yellowed grass, ice-covered puddles. There is a picnic table with flaking paint. There is a basketball court with faded lines. These edges aren't so clear anymore.
And Falling Outside Eden by Melissa Fu is published by Hedgehog Press. We've been talking on Bookmark today to Beth Lynch about her memoir, Where the Hornbeam Grows, which is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. The paperback is out on the 5th of March. We're running out of time with you, I'm afraid, but I did want to, we talked to Melissa there about Falling Outside Eden, and one of the things we haven't covered, which is another motif for the book, mm-hmm. is Paradise Lost.
Yes.
Which features in the book, and your reconnection with that as a piece of work.
Yes.
Why did you decide to include that?
I couldn't exclude it, really. The poem didn't muscle its way into my writing, but it was there. I studied 17th century literature. I mean, I have a PhD in 17th century literature. It wasn't specifically on Milton, but Milton was very much in the frame, but Milton's always been there for a lot of my life, but to begin with, it was very much an academic capacity. And when I left academia and trained as a garden designer, then we moved to Switzerland, my life was very different. And there were years, for years, I didn't actually have any kind of connection with the literature that I'd been first studying and then lecturing in, actually, as well. And one day I was out in the cottage in the Jura, and I literally took Paradise Lost off the shelf and started reading. And it's difficult to describe it. It was almost like being not a child, but being a teenager without all of those kind of preconceptions, those layers of these sort of academic critical perspectives and ways of reading and the obligations that come with that. And and I just started reading it and thinking that this is just reading it for itself on its own terms. And Milton's writing about Eden, the Garden of Eden, this wild, it's nothing like the garden that you would expect on the basis of the first few chapters of Genesis. It's wild, and it's surrounded by all this this kind of rampantly growing vegetation, and Adam and Eve are having to keep it in check constantly, and it's this place is full of life and exuberance and danger as well. Things getting sort of overgrown, and what that might involve, and what's out at the edges, and what's actually in there, in the grass, in the vegetation, all sorts of propensities for getting out of hand, and
which he does.
Which he does. Yes. Exactly.
Alert.
Exactly. And Eve. You know, Eve is the plants woman in that relationship in Milton's Eden. Adam and Eve. Yes.
And what next for you then?
I've just started writing my second book, which is actually about the sea. So it's quite going to be a very different book from the first one, though it's still non-fiction, and. Yes, it's an interesting new departure for me.
Look forward to that.
Thank you.
We'll hear your last choice of music in just a moment. But question we ask all our guests on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
I've actually recently started a novel by called Gilead by the American novelist Marilyn Robinson, and I'm stunned that I haven't come across it before. Actually, it's actually been on my shelf for a while, but I hadn't got around to reading it. And it's a wonderful, quiet, wise book about belief and families and what makes people tick. This most extraordinary meditative prose, which gives me sentence envy, I suppose.
It's a great
and
book.
I also have a book of poetry on the go by a Canadian poet called Lorna Crozier that I chanced upon in a secondhand bookshop in Winnipeg last year. So
plenty to keep you busy.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, a heads up on our next show that the studio guest is comics and manga artist Sonia Leong. We'll also hear from YA author Mike Harvey on his novel Oren Amula, Won the Call of the Mountains. And children's author Matt Dickinson will be talking to us about his story, Popcorn Eating Squirrels of the World Unite. All the old episodes of Bookmark are on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. But we'll sign out now, Beth, with with your last choice of music, which is the second movement by Rachmaninoff, Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor. Why this one?
Just because it's so beautiful and so moving. It blows my mind that Rachmaninoff produced this sublime thing from a place of depression and writer's block, and that the purity of those first few piano notes and then this kind of conversation with the flute just get me every time. This recording is it was a gift from my husband, and it's played by the absolutely marvellous pianist Stephen Huff.